Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly, maybe semi-weekly, and almost always ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very Well Armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That be you guys. You are your community's finest. With Face for Radio and a Voice for Silent Movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio, and encourage you to be a part of the show if you so choose with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participation, 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. We'll get you into the Well-Armed studio here in New Berlin. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And we've got Lon there's another way to interact with the show, and that is the chat on the Blog Talk Radio website. And we've got Lon has tuned in and is logged into the chat. So Lon, great to have you with us tonight. Excuse me while I hit some water here. So here we are, mid-November. We've got deer season coming up next week, and it's kind of a exciting time this time of year for Wisconsin. I'm not a deer hunter myself. I deer hunted in junior high, and that was about it, got to high school and just got busy with sports and girls and other stuff. And I enjoy the deer season. The bucks are getting horny because I looked out my, and by that I don't mean the professional basketball team. I looked out my great room window today and I've got a big, huge pond and some prairie that surrounds the pond. And see a doe, which is not unusual. I mean, I see does every single day, but the bucks, you don't see them much. And there's a, you know, I saw him twice. Once when I was headed off for a bike ride and I came back from my bike ride, he was still there around the pond, sniffing around the doe. But when these bucks get horny, it's the only time I see them around my pond, my property. My house has a big pond on one side with the prairie and then some trees. And then behind me is a wooded wetland. I don't know if you'd call it a forest or a wetland. It looks forested, but it's also very low. It's also tends to be a little damp back there. So a forested wetland, I guess we'll call it. But this is the only time of year that these bucks usually poke their head. Not the only time, but one of the few times a year these bucks poke their head out. And he looked pretty big. The second time I saw him, I went to grab my I have some really nice binoculars, like crazy expensive, super high. And that's the thing with binoculars. When you get the really high magnification, then sometimes they become less useful because they, at high magnification, it's hard to hold them steady enough to get a really nice, crisp image. And so I bought these Fuji image stabilization binoculars that are like crazy expensive, but they're super cool. Because they're so high powered, but then the image stabilization allows you to see pretty well. Here, Lon says a 10 pointer following a doe outside my bedroom window last week, 20 feet away. They're getting horny. So I literally saw a buck running through my backyard with a hard on one time. He's just, I should have picked up my binoculars quicker, but then I got distracted. By the time I got back over there, he was gone. And then, got a good look at him. I know he was big, but I didn't see how big. Years past, I've seen a 14 to 16 pointer back there. One was atypical. Well, I don't know if they have down times, is that considered atypical? I mean, this one was super huge. And the only thing atypical I think that I saw was a downtime. And so I don't know if a downtime makes it an atypical buck or not. I would guess it must, but I don't know if someone out there is more versed in Boone and Crockett or scoring than I would be. So, and November's, I don't know, it's October, November, kind of my favorite months of the year. I like late fall. I like fall. I like fall anytime, but later, not a huge, super huge fan of snow. Don't mind cold weather. Give me a 30 to, I mean, anything between 30 and 60. I mean, I don't need the 70s like we had last Thursday. I mean, talk about a punch in the face. It was like 77 degrees last Thursday. And then Friday, the high was like, I don't know, 30 something. I mean, just a punch in the face when I walked outside on Friday. But yeah, I don't need 70s during the fall, although I'd love it for Saturdays when I'm on the boat, late September, late October. But anything between 30 and between 30 and 60 and dry is totally fine with me. The days I don't like are the pissy rainy fall days, cold rain, that sucks. And then, it's just a great time of year. I mean, the bugs are gone. You can do whatever you want outside and not get bit by bugs and not sweat your brains out. And the cold doesn't really bother me too much. I mean, you can kind of dress for it. Snow is irritating because snow inhibits what you do, but we like to hike in the fall. After the boat goes away, we like to go hiking, which is actually what we did this weekend. We went hiking up by, this year, we're trying to, as I mentioned on other shows, we're trying to venture out a little bit further in the state than we have previously. And so weekend, we took the truck. We've been leaving late. We had left for one, we call them tramping, truck camping, one tramping trip Friday afternoon and came back Saturday night, one overnight, one night. And then that was fun. It happened to be a really cold day back in October. It was like we went up to Buckhorn State Park, and it was like 26 for a low. So we definitely tried out the sleeping ability in cold weather. That's for sure, in the truck. And it turned out okay. And then we call it trailgating. If we take the topper, put the inflatable topper on the back of the truck and go and hike, and then just hang out for a little bit after the hike, wherever the parking area is or somewhere close by, and just, do a little tailgating. We call it trailgating, where we tailgate after the hike in the back of the truck with the heater running and stuff. And then, so that's what we did Saturday. We went trailgating, but we left early. We left at like 9:30, shot up to kind of the northeastern section of the state, to an area near Bryant. I think Sherry Junction is another little town that was up there. I don't even know how to say it, but the Shemequan, I'm totally slaughtering that name, National Forest. So we're up in that area. There's a place called, we always look for someplace interesting. I always look for someplace interesting. A lot of times we try to focus on wherever the Ice Age Trail goes through places, because you just know that's a good trail. And so we went to it was called the Kettle Bowl section of the Ice Age Trail. Up by, again, it's in Langlade County, and super cool, super fun day. Interesting things about Kent Mountain, and it's something that we're going to make a little point of this year, was we look for places to go. I thought, well, let's hit all the highest peaks in Wisconsin. So there's two ways that you can classify highest peaks. There's highest peaks in terms of raw elevation, and then there's highest peaks in terms of prominence. And those are two different things, because prominence basically means, and I don't know the technical parameters, but prominence means how high a landmass / mountain / peak exists. Eben popped in the chat here. Good night. Good evening, Eben. Good to see you. Prominence is how high a mountain / peak / elevation, elevated landmass is from the nearby area. Because you could have something that's high elevation, but if it's a very gradual, I mean, just all the ground around you just gradually goes up. That's not, like, for example, we went to Kent Mountain, which is near where the Kettle Bowl segment of the Ice Age Trail goes through up in Langlade County. And there's a place called Kent Mountain Tower, which is an old abandoned fire lookout tower. So it was kind of just a destination, something to hike towards. So Kent Mountain is the fifth highest peak in Wisconsin in terms of straight up elevation, not the highest, not the fifth highest in terms of prominence, but the fifth highest in terms of raw elevation. I think it's, I don't know if it's 1900 and some feet above sea level. Now that's different than, like, for example, there's Blue Mounds, which is on our list of places to go this winter. But again, I didn't look up the technical definition, but Blue Mounds, I think, is the highest elevation and highest peak in terms of prominence, meaning how high is it compared to the land around it? I don't know if that's compared to land like within a mile radius or whatever, or, you know, how, because, like, for example, Gibraltar Rock is one of the highest points in Wisconsin in terms of prominence, but not even in the top 10, I don't believe, in terms of highest elevation, in terms of elevation from sea level. So Kent Mountain is the highest peak in terms of elevation, fifth highest peak in terms of elevation from sea level. In the event that anybody was wondering what the other ones were, I mean, I actually have them handy here. I'll pop these up real quick. So Blue Mounds is the highest. It's only 1,700 feet of elevation, 1,719 feet of elevation, which, again, we were at Kent Mountain is 1,900 some feet, but it's got 935 feet of prominence, meaning that that's how high it sticks up from the area around it. And, like, to give you an example, there's, like, Gibraltar Rock is 1,257 feet of elevation. So it's like 500 feet lower than Blue Mounds. But Gibraltar Rock, again, in terms of prominence, is one of the highest peaks. Again, in terms of prominence, Gibraltar Rock is one of the highest peaks. I want to say it's like third or fourth or something like that. But then you've got like there's a place called Happy Hill, which is 1,486 feet above sea level. The West Bluff of Devil's Lake is 1,467 feet above sea level, but its prominence is only 312 feet. Now, 312 feet is still a lot of prominence. I think it puts it in the top 10. Well, let me run down the list for you. So the highest point in Wisconsin is called Tim's Hill. Let me get my, now I'm trying to. Using a particular website. So highest. Let me rephrase that. I guess there's two that are tied. There's Pearson Hill and Tim's Hill. They're both 1,949 feet of elevation. Tim's Hill has 430 feet of prominence. So that means compared to the surrounding land, how high does it protrude? Pearson Hill is 1,949 feet as well. And it's not too far from Tim's Hill, but that's only got 144 feet of prominence. So basically it's a more gradual rise up to there. You've got Sugarbush Hill, which is 1,936 feet of prominence, 1,936 feet of elevation, but only 358 feet of prominence. Another one called Lookout Mountain. I've been looking at these earlier in the week and I looked at where they were, but I'd have to go back and refresh my memory, exact parts of state, some of these. Lookout Mountain only has 328 feet of prominence. So then you've got Rib Mountain, which is 1,923 feet of elevation. So just slightly shorter than Pearson Hill and Tim's Hill, but it's got 630 feet of prominence, meaning that from the surrounding area, it's a quick, you know, you're 630 feet. Then there's Kent Lookout. That's where we were. Kent Lookout is 1,903 feet of elevation, but the prominence is only 266 feet. Now, again, I don't know how far out you have to go to get the, it's like within a mile of the base, from the peak to the base. So it was quite an upward climb. But anyway, so we went up to Kent Mountain, and it was super cool. But that's just to give you an idea of some of the things we're going to do this winter is hit some of these high peaks. Eben asked her in the chat, have you gone snowshoeing or cross-country skiing through those areas? No. I haven't cross-country skied since I was in college, and same thing with snowshoeing. The reason we haven't gone snowshoeing is because, one, my fiance doesn't think she'd like it. I think she said she snowshoed once in her life, and she's not interested. But the other reason is I've yet to find snowshoes that will fit the dog. And if you find snowshoes that fit a German Shepherd, 107 pound German Shepherd, let me know. But you know, we could throw on snowshoes, but some of the places, you know, you generally, I think you don't need snowshoes till it's at least, I want to say like 6 inches of snow or more before snowshoes are really necessary or helpful. So a lot of the trails that we go to are already packed down and you don't need, they're already kicked in and you don't need snowshoes. Some of these places that we're hiking now, I think in the winter you would need snowshoes, but we won't be going there in the winter because again, we would be fine, but the dog's going to, you know, the dog's not going to want to post hole his way through, you know, 20 inches of snow in order to, that would be super tiring for the dog and super chafing for his Johnson dragging through the snow all the whole hike. But, so yeah, that's the only reason why we haven't, done the snowshoeing thing. Otherwise, I think I'd probably try to talk my fiance into trying out snowshoeing. But anyway, those are the highest, that was just by elevation, by prominence, the highest mountains or highest peaks in Wisconsin is Blue Mounds, which has 935. I think that's down by Dodgeville, kind of southwest of Madison, 935 feet of prominence. And you got Rib Mountain with 630 feet of prominence. And you got Sauk Point We've been really close to that. The Ice Age Trail goes real close to that, which has 594 feet of prominence. Meteor Hill, 505 feet of prominence, 1,801 feet of elevation. Happy Hill, which is 1,486 feet of elevation above sea level, but 479 feet of prominence. Then Eagle Bluff, Flambeau Ridge, Powder Hill. Powder Hill's over by, I think it's by Slinger. Hartford Slinger area. I think by Hartford, more closer to Hartford. But anyway, just to give you a little trivia there on Wisconsin geography. So we went to Kent Mountain. They've got that abandoned fire lookout tower, which is super cool. I wanted to climb it, but I thought maybe the ladder would, I should have known better, but the ladder ends like 12 feet, 16 feet off the ground. And so you can kind of scale the beams on the, it's like a radio tower construction, steel construction. You can kind of scale the beams to get up to where the ladder, it's just a runged ladder. And I started going up and I'm like, yeah, I think I could get up there to get to the ladder and then scramble up to the top easily on the rung ladder. But it was a little bit sketch. And I didn't have good gloves and my boots were sticking. My hiking boots stuck really well on the steel girders, the kind of angled steel girders to get up to where the bottom of the ladder was. But I didn't have any gloves. And so being like 32 degrees or whatever with occasional snow and wind, it was breezy and it was chilly up there. And the steel radio tower was super cold. And so I was a little disappointed in myself that I didn't make it up to climb the tower itself and get the view from up there, but it just didn't seem safe. And we were also running late, and it was funny because I like things that scare me a little bit. If you were listening earlier in the year, I told about how we took a dinghy over to Rock Island. Took the truck up to Washington Island, took the ferry over to Washington Island, and then drove to Jackson Harbor, and then took an inflatable dinghy. I think it's a 10-foot inflatable dinghy with an 8-horsepower Yamaha motor, or maybe it was a Honda motor, anyway, over to Rock Island on April 15th. And Rock Island is serviced by a passenger ferry during the summer, small passenger ferry. But after like October between, I think the ferry starts maybe around Memorial Day, and it ends October 15th. So outside of that time, there's no way to get there unless you have your own boat. So we went over there and had the island to ourselves hiking, and it was a windy day. It's called Death's Door. The wind was blowing straight in, and so it got pretty sketch on the way over to Rock Island. Then we got behind the jetty and got in the boathouse, and there's still icebergs in the boathouse. And then I was like, man, I looked, and usually the wind tends to calm down later in the day. I looked at the wind prediction maps, and actually the wind was supposed to speed up later in the day. So I was like, oh man, should we just turn around and go back now? I mean, we just made this treacherous trip over from Jackson Harbor. First half of it was fine. The second half was a little bit sketch with, 3-foot waves and a little dinghy. And then we're like, well, heck, we'll just hike. So we did our hike and then came back, and it was the most scared I've ever been making a crossing. And then, of course, we got in the dinghy. I was hoping the dinghy would start because it was so cold. The motor started. Everything was going okay. Okay, we're good. And then once we got to around the jetty from Rock Island, 4-foot wave, boom, broke over the bow of the little dinghy. We were soaked within seconds of getting out from behind, and we got another, 15-minute crossing over Death's Door to make. It was a sketchy ride back, it was probably the most scared I had been. But then when we got back, of course, then you're like we made it, and it was super exciting, and it was euphoric. I mean, it's that adrenaline rush and the relief of making it. And so our hike on Saturday was kind of like that up at Kent Mountain, because we get up there. Just by the nature of our logistics and timing, we didn't get there until we were probably about an hour late than we wanted to be. We wanted to be there at 1:00. Sun goes down early this time of year. And it was an eerie day. Like one minute it was like really heavy snow / that guapple. It's kind of like snowballs, little tiny snowballs, they call it. And then the next minute the sun would pop out. Breezy, cold, right around freezing, 32, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. And then the territory, the terrain is so much different up in the northeast part of the state when you get to that Chemequan or whatever it's called, National Forest. Even the roads, like down here in the southern part of the state, I mean, everything's paved. You know, there's really not much, if any, dirt roads or gravel roads. You get up to the northeastern part of the state when you're almost to the UP, and you know, there's a lot of the roads are not paved. They're, you know, gravel / crushed stone. And then I wasn't even sure, like, Waze, to its credit, took me down some back roads that, like, I mean, the backest of back roads. I mean, some of these roads, like, you couldn't take a car down them. I mean, you needed to be in a truck with some good ground clearance. Like, there's no way you would take, like, a sports car or even, like, a regular passenger sedan. Some of these, you know, they had, I don't want to call them boulders, but they had protruding rocks sticking, you know, 6 to 8 inches up from the surface of the road. A lot of these roads are used by UTVs as well, but I mean, Waze routed me down one that was called like Whiskey Hill Road, and it was so narrow. There's no way two cars could have passed each other that I'm like, okay, is this even meant for vehicles or is this just for UTVs? So I backed up and I took a little different route to get back to where we were going to park. And but it was sketchy. I mean, it was the backest of back roads I've ever been on in my life with a vehicle. Well, I shouldn't say that. In high school, once I drove my Mustang down a really back access road, but I mean, that was more like a ditch going, an old service road going back to this party area, O'Reilly Road out in Rock County, where high school kids used to party. But anyway, so it was late in the day when we got up there. By the time we got hiking, it was like 1:50. It was almost 2 o'clock. The sun goes down at 4:30. So, and then the trails were really poorly marked, and there was so many of them. Like when you hike the Ice Age Trail, they've got these yellow blazes that they put on the trees and you can just follow so you know you're on the trail. That said, most of the Ice Age Trail is so well kicked in, you don't even need to look for the yellow blazes. I mean, occasionally the Ice Age Trail crosses, you know, some of the other trails through the state forest, through the Kettle Moraines, the Bridle Path and the Moraine Ridge trails and some of the snowmobile trails. So, you know, but even there, you can tell which one's the Ice Age. Ice Age is usually, you know, 3 feet wide with a real well kicked in single rut trail. And the snowmobile trails and the bridle paths are very wide. You know, they're 8-10 feet wide because people drive snowmobiles down them and take their horses down them in the different seasons. So, but up there, the Ice Age Trail isn't, well, certainly the northeastern part of the state, the Ice Age Trail doesn't get much traffic. So it's not kicked in like a really well-established footpath that you're used to seeing. And then these UTV trails go everywhere. I mean, these UTV trails like cross and this way. And I mean, it's like nothing's really well marked. And then there's no cell service. So up here, you know, when you're hiking in the Kettle Moraine, even the Southern Kettle Moraine, you're not too far from civilization. You take a wrong turn on a trail, you're going to end up at a road within 2 miles. Well, up here, it's just wilderness for miles and miles and miles. And there's so many roads that if you head down the wrong road, I mean, I could see where you could get lost so easy. And then these UTV roads and these old logging roads, there's so many of them and they crisscross that even just to keep track of them, like which turns you made, would be super difficult. And to make it worse, again, no cell service. So I have these preloaded, I use like a Plotter Route. It's an app that and a website that has trails, and you can use your GPS function on your phone, and it keeps so you can make sure you can plot your route ahead of time, and then make sure that you're on your route. And if you get off your route, you can look down and say, "Oh, I'm," you know, using the GPS function off your route. Well, the GPS function wasn't working on that website. It hasn't been for a couple weeks for me. And so I preloaded cached the Google Maps and then the route for Plata route that I was going to take, but I couldn't mark myself on it. So it was just all of a sudden, all these things, all these factors are kind of adding up. I'm like, okay, it's really cold today. It's windy. There's wilderness for miles, like nothing I've ever hiked in before. The trail is poorly marked and there's no cell service and the GPS function on my phone's not working well. And all of a sudden I was like, this is a little dangerous. this hike today is a bit dangerous. You could see where, and then after we left, I usually take a flashlight. I didn't take my flashlight with because I have a really nice Ace Beam, which is a super nice flashlight, but it's heavy. Didn't necessarily want to lug that. Probably should have. You know, it's got a belt strap, so I could have. You know, we're running late, so I didn't want to go back to the truck. That would have been backtracking a quarter mile when I thought about bringing the flashlight, looking at the time of day. So all of a sudden, I'm like, okay, we're hiking late in the day. The weather's not ideal. Dangerously cold if we end up out here after dark. It would be easy to get lost with all these crossroads and logging roads and not be able to tell right from left from any. You could easily be walking in circles forever. I mean, you think, okay, just – you know, try to keep going straight. But again, you could go 15 miles before you end up at a road, a main road. So, and even the main roads don't have that much traffic up there. But so obviously I called my, every once in a while, we get to a peak of a hilly area where we did have cell service, no internet, but I called my daughter who is back here in New Berlin. And I actually said, hey, you know, this hike is a little sketchy. There's the cell service is really bad. The internet's gone. There's no internet. I can make a call, but they get no internet. And my GPS on my phone isn't working for the app, so I can't really follow our route real well. And there's so many cross trails. It's going to be hard to make our way back. So I said, if you don't hear from us by 6, start to worry, 6 p.m. And then if, you know, try to get a hold of us and stuff. And if you don't get a hold of us by 7 p.m., if you don't hear from us by 7 p.m., call the Langley County Sheriff's Department and tell them that, you know, your parents are up here hiking and they were supposed to check in and you didn't hear from them. And I gave her the location of where we parked the truck and stuff. So, cause I was actually a little bit worried that, you know, it wasn't at the point of danger, but it was, you know, something goes wrong and I could see it being a life threatening type of situation. So we got up, you know, it was about a 6 mile route that we had planned. When you know you have 3 hours of daylight left, I'm like, okay, hour and a half. At an hour and a half point, we got to turn around and head back because, you know, hour and a half out, hour and a half back, that's all the daylight we got. But then again, heading back wasn't an assured thing because we had taken so many turns trying to follow. And I thought, man, the Ice Age trail isn't marked well. There's all these cross paths, UTV trails, and everyone looks the same. And there's literally like a dozen crossing paths that all look the same. It's not like one of them is more worn than the other. They're just, some of them, you actually, the ones we ended up taking were not quite as worn as the path that crossed it. So, it was a little sketchy. I started getting a little bit worried, not super worried, but a little bit worried. And then, I'm like, okay, I don't even know if we're going to make our goal of getting to Kent Mountain and to see the tower and to be at that highest peak. So anyway, we did get there. It took us about an hour and a half to get out there. And then I did take a different route back. What I had to do was my Google map that was cached, the GPS was working on that. So that was kind of my saving grace. The GPS on my Google Maps was working, but my Google Maps didn't have my route plotted on it. So I just had to kind of wing it. And, I did have my phone as a compass. So, you know, there was, if worse came to worse and we got, you know, I think I could have, using the Google Maps and the GPS in there, safely made it back to the truck, even if it had gotten dark and that kind of thing. I think I would have been okay. But again, it was just a little bit sketch. So it was super cool and a bit exciting with just a hint of danger, not overt danger, but just a hint of danger. So a beautiful area. But yeah, ways to get to where we our parking area. I mean, it took me down some roads that I'm not sure were passenger vehicles, but it was, you know, one of them was so narrow. I wanted to give it a shot, you know, be a little off-roading in my truck, but, you know, I didn't want to anger the locals or the law enforcement, obviously. But it's just nice to get out to different parts of the state that you don't usually see. I mean, the geography is different. And, for example, we're driving through some of these back roads, and I see these, like, this blue piping. It's like, you know, tiny blue piping about the size of, oh, I don't know. Some of it was about the size of blue piping, like if you've ever seen maybe a little bit bigger than the water supply line to a refrigerator, kind of clear, but with a bluish tint, this blue rubber tubing. And it was just looped around trees and then had these cables supporting it, these, you know, wires supporting it. I'm like, what is that? There was a part where it went up and over the road in a little bit of a larger diameter blue piping line. And some of it kind of almost looked like that PEX that goes into houses for plumbing. And so, Lon already said it. So I speculated to my fiance, I'm like, what is that? I'm like, is it like an automated maple syrup facility? But we weren't sure. And couldn't really see where they were tapped into the trees necessarily. They were looped around trees. So anyway, I had to come back and Google it. Yeah, Lon just answered the question. Well, it's maple syrup, and there's, I guess, gravity-fed systems and then vacuum systems where they actually use a vacuum pressure to pull the maple syrup into the processing building that they use. So, but again, I'd never seen that before in my life. I mean, I've seen maple trees that were being tapped for syrup, but there was a tap and a bucket hanging on the end. That's the old fashioned way. So it's cool to get out to different parts of the state and see the different geography, and it definitely makes you feel like you're in some place different. And that's pretty cool. So anyway, moving on today, make a quick comment on this. This is funny. You know, the NFL kind of amuses me, and it was really, I guess, more Fox, because this morning I was Fox News. I happened to have Channel 6 on when I got up, and Fox News was doing the Fox NFL pregame show. They were doing it from, because of Veterans Day, I guess Veterans Day was Thursday. I think Veterans Day was Thursday. It was a Friday. Anyway, Veterans Day was late last week. And then they said in celebration or in honor of Veterans Day, they were going to be doing a broadcast from Qatar, from a military base in Qatar. And I thought, okay, you know, it's the typical symbolic faux patriotism annual event that Fox News does. They usually do that Fox Sports does. They usually do a broadcast from one of the military installation. I've seen them do it from San Diego. I've seen them do it from other places. And so they do that like once a year during the football season. Again, it's kind of a faux patriotism from the Fox network, because I don't think the Fox Sports executives are all that patriotic kind of guys. But, you know, it was tied to Veterans Day. Well, then they started, silence my computer down here a bit. Well, then once they get there, they've got the NFL pregame show on Fox, and they start talking about Euro soccer. I was like, okay. So the football analysts, the football anchors are talking about Euro soccer and what's the soccer equivalent of Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. And there is such a desire from these networks, Fox especially, just to push Euro soccer, from the major networks, to push Euro soccer on America, on the American audience. It astonishes me. And so then it's like, okay, then they were on the set that this, cause the World Cup is going to be in Qatar. And so then they were also doing some scenes, some shots from the set of the World Cup, which hasn't started yet, but the set of the World Cup, they were doing, say, this is the Fox studio for the NFL, for the World Cup games, for however long it goes on, if it's 2 weeks or whatever, a month away. But I thought, okay, so you didn't really go there. You wanted to go do a marketing push for Euro soccer, and you use the excuse of Veterans Day and going to a military base in Qatar for the self-serving purpose of cross-promoting Euro soccer to the American football audience. I thought it was a tacky ass move by Fox Sports. Look, if you want to go cross promote, and they, all these networks do it, they try to cross. You'll remember that, multiple TV shows and multiples. It's not unusual that sports programming brings someone on from a new television series that network is going to run. I mean, they do that to cross promote. I don't think they used to do it much in the past, but I mean, in the last decade or two, it's been a common practice. But I thought it was really tacky to, oh, we're going to an NFL base, military base in Qatar to be with the troops on Veterans Day. And then, oh, the day comes and, oh, here's our set for the NFL. Here's our set for the World Cup matches. Let's talk World Cup soccer. And it's like, okay, you had an ulterior motive to go to Qatar, and it wasn't to be with the troops. It was to cross promote the World Cup, which I guess Fox is going to be broadcasting to the NFL audience under this, again, this faux patriotism, symbolic show up at a military base installation. I thought it was tacky. Not surprising for a major network, but tacky nonetheless. But it's an interesting, amusing case study in marketing and business. And you see it a lot, but it's interesting when a business starts to try to leverage its customer base with something outside of its core product. You know, Fox NFL broadcasters pushing Euro soccer, really, and again, it's not the NFL, it's Fox Network, but Fox Network pushing Euro soccer. I don't think the NFL cares, but the Fox Broadcasting Network, Fox Sports Broadcasting Network, they're the ones that I think are carrying the World Cup, and they want to drive up ratings for that. But it's, to me, it's like, I mean, you got to still kind of know your audience. Trying to push Euro soccer on American football fans is just, to me, a really tone-deaf move. I mean, it's like you show up to your favorite supper club looking for steak, mashed potatoes, and a beer, or an old-fashioned, and they hand you a menu for sushi and martinis. I mean, you could say, oh, food is food. We want you to try something new. But again, know your audience. I mean, I'm sure Fox is saying, oh, sports is sports. NFL sports fans, let's get the NFL sports fanatic. They like sports. They'll like soccer. I mean, I think it was an epic fail in my opinion, but that was just amusing. I don't know if anybody else, I don't sit down to watch football, but I don't have cable. So I turn on the TV when I'm making breakfast, and that was what was on. I got up late. That was what was on when I was making breakfast. And I couldn't help but be amused by the what I thought was a miss in terms of their attempt to cross promote. And you throw in the, so it was multiple things. First, it was hijacking a sense of what was promoted as a patriotic event for actually a commercial purpose of cross promotion of the World Cup and Fox's coverage of the World Cup. But then also just that separately, even if it hadn't been trying to hijack the patriotism and take away and forget the military base angle of it, if just Fox trying to push, because they could do this in the here as well. I mean, they could just as easily from the California studio for Fox Sports be pushing the World Cup during the NFL pregame broadcast. And that would still be a miss, even if they took out the shameless attempt to connect the military patriotism stuff to it. But anyway, man, I'm getting stuffy tonight. If you guys notice that, I get every week when I do the show, I don't know if I'm mouth breathing when I'm talking, And so then my nose gets stuffy. Every time I do a broadcast, my nose gets stuffy. But so I want to spend the rest of the show talking about the election results, which at any other point was a decent night for Republicans on Tuesday, but just given what had been predicted by the conservative pundits, you know, your Clay Travis and Buck Sexton, you're here in Milwaukee, your local television, your local conservative talk radio hosts. But I want to first start with just forget the commentary and the punditry. You know, Ron Johnson wins and Tim Michaels didn't. And to me, I thought if one wins, the other's going to win. And so I thought that was an interesting race to talk about here. Both Ron Johnson and Tim Michaels, well, I know Tim Michaels was outspent by a huge margin by Tony Evers. Tony Evers had way more money to spend on advertising. I think Ron Johnson was outspent. I'm pretty sure he was outspent to a large degree. But so he proves that you don't have to overspend. You know, it's not straight up dollars. You know, you don't have to advertise. It's not the one with the most ads wins. So it's not that you have to outspend your opponent in the governor's race, in the U.S. Senate race, but I think you do have to hit back. And I think that Ron Johnson, the lies and the negative commercials that were thrown his way, I think Ron Johnson responded to those with his commercials. But Tim Michaels didn't. So I think the three issues, and there's multiple reasons that I think Tim Michaels lost. And he didn't lose by a lot. So when you lose a relatively close race, like any one of these things that I'm going to talk about in the next half hour, I think could have shifted the race. I don't think it would have had to do all of them, but I think even acting better strategy, better execution on any one of these, and Tim Michaels might have won. So the first one I'm going to mention is this not hitting back on the negative ads. There was negative ads against Michaels on abortion that misrepresented Tim Michaels' position. Then there was the sexual harassment attack ads, which he never refuted or put in any kind of context. And then there was the ads that said that Tim Michaels said something like gay people shouldn't leave the house, which is not what he said. He did say, and they had the quote from him where he said, you know, the problem I have is when you bring it out into the public street, which was something he said decades ago. But he never responded to that either. He just left all those negative attacks percolate. And again, I think there was a good response to each of them. Like on the abortion one, again, you don't let your opponent set the tone. So in every instance, I think if someone's with these negative ads, you respond to the ad, discredit it, and then go on offense, play offense in the same ad. For example, abortion. It said Tim Michaels is against abortion, and even in the case of a mother and mother's life and rape and incest, and that he would arrest doctors. I mean, that was what all the ads said. Some of the ads said one of those things, all those things, but I mean, that was the scope of what the negative abortion ad said. Now, Tim Michaels goes on conservative talk radio and says, hey, if the legislature, I'm against abortion, period, but if the legislature gets me a bill that makes abortion legal until 15 weeks and for the life of the mother, I'll sign it, which is a pretty moderate position. Well, he goes on WISN on talk radio, conservative talk radio, to make that announcement. And that's an audience that was probably voting for him anyway. Eben says, Michaels was far too evasive when asked deep questions of the day. Yeah, that's true, but I don't think that really hurt him. I think on these three issues it did. But like when you ask him about certain things, like whether it was MPS, well, I'll take a look at it. But see, Trump was kind of that way too on certain issues. Trump would just say, well, we're going to take a look at it. But I think that these critical issues, abortion, Michael's never responded, and he should have put out an ad and say, hey, look. And again, the first part of the ad, refute the negative ad. The second part of the ad, go on offense. Because you know me, defense does not win elections. Playing defense does not win elections. Playing defense does not win politics. But you can play a little bit of defense as long as you then go on offense. So the abortion ad should have been for Michaels that he's personally against abortion, but he's not going to impose his personal beliefs on other people, and that he's willing to support if the legislature gets a bill to his desk to allow abortion after up to 15 weeks, he'll sign it. And then the second half of the ad say what he will never support is killing unborn babies that are 1 week from full term, which is Tony Evers' position. What he'll never support is allowing a baby to be born alive and then aborted, even though it was born alive and could have survived outside of the mother. It was literally already born, because that's Tony Evers' position. The Democrat position is no restrictions on abortion up to and including live birth. And that is barbaric. Me personally, I think that one's religious beliefs would probably dictate that prior to that abortion after conception is probably immoral by most religious beliefs. And again, it's above my pay grade. I'm not God, but God probably doesn't approve of abortion after conception. But so for me, I would say abortion is probably immoral after conception. It should be legal up until viability. Again, let's just pick a date and say 16 weeks. And it's barbaric late term. And I think I think the majority of people agree with that. Now, there's some Republicans who are like, they like the ban like it is, and they're happy to have their politicians go down in flames clinging to Wisconsin's abortion ban. It has no exceptions. So that's how Tim Michaels, I think, could have hit back on the abortion issue. Say, look, I will support a bill that makes abortion legal prior to 15 weeks, but I will never support a bill like Tony Evers, or I'll never support a law like Tony Evers that allows babies a week from full term to be aborted and murdered, or babies to be born alive and then, quote, aborted outside of the mother. I will never support that. That's what he should have done on the abortion issue. He never did it. When it came to sexual harassment, those ads about the sexual harassment, he should have gone on and said, look, Michaels Corporation has 8,000 employees. We have offices in, I don't know how many states it is, a dozen states, 40 states, 20 states, 30 states. I mean, it's a lot. And there's been 5 instances over the last 20 years. So on average, 8,000 employees, on average, 1 sexual harassment complaint that was deemed legitimate, which warranted a settlement, every 4 years. During some of that time, I wasn't even in the same state. I was out in New York running an operation out there. When these ads talk about higher ups, they're talking about construction worker and foreman. They're not talking about higher ups being the CEO of the company. I mean, it's just, this is a pathetic attack. And then play offense in the second half of the ad and point out that there was teachers caught with child pornography in classrooms, and Tony Evers, as school superintendent, would not fire them. So again, respond to the attack, put it in context, and then play offense. That's how she should have addressed the sexual harassment thing with an ad or two. And then the thing about gay people leaving their house, which is not what he said. He didn't think the gay people should leave their house. He said, the problem I have is when you bring it out into the public street. And I don't want to – he said that he made that comment like 20 years ago or something like that. What he should have said is, when I made the comment that I did about keeping your sexual life private, was at that time, Obama didn't think that gay people should be allowed to marry either. And Obama's position is different today, and my position is different today. And that's how he should have addressed that. But he never did. And I'm sitting there in like early October and September, and some of these ads are getting run, and I'm thinking to myself, why isn't Tim Michaels hitting back with an ad to respond to these and then play up? And then I heard Tim Michaels on probably Dan O'Donnell's show, and he said, look, Dan, I'm a businessman. I have, you know, X years of business experience and strategy, and we've got a strategy and a plan to address all this. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just trust him. So I thought Tim Michaels must have polling to show that those ads weren't being effective against him. And now I realize that I shouldn't have trusted him. I thought that come October, Tim Michaels would come out with his big advertising campaign, save his money till later in the race, and then hit back hard before Tony Evers' people had time to really respond to his rebuttals. But those ads just never came. And so I think that's those three things. If Tim Michaels would have spent some money on some ads for those, he could have done better. Probably could have won. Now, the good news. The good news is Ron Johnson won, and a Republican won a statewide race in Wisconsin. And that's huge, because I wasn't sure if that was possible. After 2020, which I'm confident, I would bet my life the 2020 election was stolen. And I would even bet that it was stolen with extraordinary cheating methods, that because there's always been fraud. But stolen with extraordinary cheating methods. I mean, watch the documentary 2000 Mules. I mean, it's not to overuse the word, it's documented in this documentary with verifiable sources what they had these mules doing. And then you hear about the fraud that was uncovered here in Wisconsin at nursing homes and the number of people in nursing homes. And it's, you know. So for Ron Johnson to win a statewide race, like after 2020, I wasn't sure if that was possible. So Ron Johnson clearly overcame the margin of fraud to win. So that's really good news, because that gives me hope. Like I wasn't sure that a Republican could ever win a statewide race, because once Democrats figure out how to steal elections, they'll keep doing it. Ron Johnson said that they had last election, 2020, there was 1,600 poll workers. Now they had 5,000 poll workers watching the entire chain of command, watching the chain of command from ballot, from precincts to central count, watching the whole process. And so that's good that a Republican can win a statewide race. And then you look at then talk about this red wave. Everybody's like, red wave, red wave, red wave. Like, I don't think that a red wave is possible, because Democrats have the barrier reef of the media. And so I think all this talk about a red wave, the polling in Wisconsin never showed a red wave. But the pundits kept talking about red wave, everybody from Dan O'Donnell to Clay Travis, Buck Sexton, and others. And so I think that that was stupid on the part of the Republican talking heads to talk about this red wave, because look, what did I say last week? I said, Democrats are loyal to party and motivated as fuck. Republicans are not loyal to party. They are loyal to their principles, and actually to a fault, because they want perfect candidates and they are not motivated or active politically. Republicans, conservatives, they tend to be motivated personally with their business, with their family, with their private life, with living their own life, live and let live. So it's against their nature to be like activists. It's Democrats' nature to be activists, to want to tell other people what to do, force other people what to do. So that's a very steep contradiction to overcome when you look at Democrats compared to Republicans. But look at information. To the average millennial / Generation Z, the information that they were getting inflation is COVID and Putin's fault. So Republicans sit here and say, oh, inflation's so bad and supply chain issues and all sort of stuff, and people are going to reflexively go away from the party in power because how bad the economy is. But that was short-sighted because mainstream media is no longer the big news networks. Mainstream media is pro sports, it's pro athletes, it's Hollywood, it's actors and actresses, it's the music industry and musicians, it's late night comedy talk shows, it's big tech, fascist book, Instagram, YouTube, Google. Many of these Democrat voters have no idea what they're voting for. They're completely ignorant on policy, and they have no idea what's actually going on, and it's virtually impossible to reach them. Everyone they are exposed to, the things I just listed above, is telling them to vote Democrat. And they think all the ills of the world are solved by voting Democrat. They are the useful idiots that the left has complete control over. And in 2020, they had to steal the election. In 2022, they just had to stick a ballot in front of the useful idiots and make it a brainless process. And Democrats have a phenomenal get-out-the-vote ground game. And Republicans have none of that. And so turnout in Madison was like 90% turnout. And then you find out, oh, they had voting booths, staffed voting booths at the UW dormitories across the state. Now, I heard someone say that's 160,000 students. Now, I don't know if that means, excuse me. Now, I'm sure they weren't even just in dorms. I'm sure they were in dorms and they probably had voting booths in the, you know, the university commons. So, yeah, you take 160,000, I don't know if that's 160,000 students that stay in on-campus housing, dormitory housing, UW housing on the various campuses, or if 160,000 is the total number of enrolled students. I'd have to think that's probably total number of enrolled students in the UW system. But when you got a voting booth at the University Commons, you got a voting booth and a staff voting booth in every dormitory, you walk in the door, did you vote? And then what's the one thing? See, Democrats, they're so damn smart. What did Joe Biden do a month ago, month and a half ago, month before the election? He put out the proposal to forgive $10,000 or $20,000 of student loans. Well, talk about dragging red meat through a trailer park. He puts out that proposal for the sole purpose of making it super easy for all these people to go to colleges and universities and get virtually every student to vote for the Democrats. Because then on the news, they talk about Republicans trying to... So that the messaging was so easy. Vote Democrat if you want your student debt forgiven. Now, amongst the general voting population, like adults, many found that offensive. Even some Democrats found that offensive. But that wasn't the target audience. This was a very calculated move by Joe Biden to forgive student debt, because then that chummed the waters at every college and university across the country, so that all they had to do was stick these voting booths with us, these staff voting booths at these public universities, and the sales pitch had already been given. Vote for Democrats, get your student debt forgiven. Again, you talk about people that are in their 30s and 40s, people who already paid off their student debt, they're offended by that proposal. Did it change their vote though? Nah, probably not. But even the media was saying, yeah, this has been met with some bipartisan objections. So what? Joe Biden knew exactly what he was doing. His team knew what they were doing. They were priming the voting pump at every university around the country, which is where they were going to go to get their votes come November, come this past election. And that's a phenomenal ground game. Republicans have none of that. Some other thoughts that I have, you know, I listen to Dan O'Donnell, which I have to turn him off sometimes now because I just, like, Dan O'Donnell is not a good analyst. I mean, he makes predictions and provides analysis. For this is now for people living in the southeastern part of the state that hear Dan O'Donnell and WISN. Now, I think he's syndicated across states. So I think people in other parts of the state might hear him as well. But he's not a good analyst. He makes predictions and provides analysis that he thinks is so prescient, and it turns out to be wrong. And he never comes back and says, yeah, I was wrong, or responds to it. But some recent examples and some past examples. July 2017, Scott Walker landed the Foxconn deal. Dan O'Donnell says, well, this pretty much guarantees Walker's reelection next year, which was totally off. Walker ends up losing in 2018. On election day this year, Dan O'Donnell says, oh, I predict there's going to be over 3 million votes, you know, and he was 400,000 votes short. He thought voter turnout was just going to be off the charts. It wasn't. So, like, I actually wrote an email to Dan O'Donnell. I've talked to him before. He's called me on a couple things when I was sent some local issues his way. But I wrote this to Dan O'Donnell, and this is the question I pose is the talk radio effect gone? So I sent this email to Dan. I said, hey, Dan, as a business owner, I like to hear opinions from customers, even those that I don't enjoy hearing. It allows me to make decisions and improve my offering to my customers. As you might have noticed, I was very critical of your approach to the Republican primary in comments on the YouTube channel and probably the text line also, because WISN has a text and talk line. You claimed you were doing a full vetting of the candidates so that Republicans could make a good choice in the primary. I think the term used by Wisconsin Right Now during your show was, so we don't get Hagedorn. Not sure if you adopted that term, but you did make it clear that was your intent. I think what you really ended up doing was exposing all the negatives of candidates, especially Michaels, to turn off a segment of Republican voters at the end of the day. Michaels did notably bad in Southeast Wisconsin, WISN's big market. I was distributing Johnson Michaels signs in New Berlin. There were people with a Johnson sign in their yard who very indignantly said no when I asked them if they'd like a Michaels sign as well. I think while you were vetting candidates in the primary, what you ended up doing was alienating a segment of voters for each who, come general election, were then unmotivated to get out for the Republican that wasn't their choice in the primary. Rush Limbaugh being the gold standard, he stayed out of the primaries for the most part. The commentary he did make was usually just to explain, for example, Trump versus trying to vet Trump versus Cruz. It was a Republican primary, and Republicans and or people listening to talk radio are more informed and engaged than average voters. They don't need a talking head influencing them in a primary. They do like getting information that a popular talk radio host gets from insiders that they themselves don't have connections to get. There are a lot of reasons Michaels lost. I think he failed to respond to the negative attacks, abortion, comments on homosexuals, sexual harassment claims. Johnson did respond to the attacks on him. I understand Michaels was outspent, but I sat all October wondering why Michaels didn't address these attacks on TV. But that said, during the Walker years, there was a talk radio effect in Southeast Wisconsin. It seems that talk radio effect is gone. If I was WISN, I would ask why. If I was talk radio, I'd ask myself if exposing the negatives of some of the candidates, let's be honest, the negatives of Clee Fishy were glossed over, acknowledged in passing, she was an insider, and not dove into. The negatives of Michaels got a deep dive. So if I was talk radio, I'd be asking myself if exposing the negatives of some of the candidates does something to suppress Republican enthusiasm come the general election. Aside from that angle, I'd also point out that from a purely listener enjoyment standpoint, what benefit would it be to anger a segment of your listeners every time you tried to litigate the primary candidates on your show? And I'm going to interject now. Dan O'Donnell used to say that. He said, oh, if I got Michael's people mad at me and I got the Clee Fish people mad at me, then I must be doing a good job because that means I'm being fair. Well, who died and made you the person who needs to make people mad? I mean, Rush Limbaugh's, I don't think Rush Limbaugh ever sat down and said, oh, I want to offend the Donald Trump in 2016. If I offend the Trump supporters today and if I offend the Ted Cruz supporters today, then I'm doing my job. I think he approached it in a way to try not to offend his fellow conservatives, respect their intelligence, and maybe just provide a little bit of information to explain Trump's positions without trying to vet one candidate, because it's really, insulting to, I think, the Republican candidate, voters to have to vet their – we don't need our candidates pre-chewed by talk radio for us. I mean, sure, if you guys get some information, Rush Limbaugh knew Donald Trump, so he could give some insider information about how Trump really is, that he's not an ideologue, that everything he is based upon business experiences. But he didn't try to vet one candidate over the other. That was just, you know, he just gave people information that they wouldn't have access to. Back to my email to Dan O'Donnell. I said, if it was me, I would use the time. Let me back up one more. I don't think you stand to gain anything angering Michael's supporters 1 minute and Cleefish supporters the next. I don't think it's good for your audience enjoyment. And ultimately, I don't think it's good for the general election. If it was me, I would use the time during primary season to highlight issues Republican candidates should take advantage of as they make their case in the primary. Give them opportunities to become a better general election candidate on issues that will drive the general. Whoever does it best will win the primary. I would expose the flaws of Democrats so Republican candidates in the general can take advantage of that. A deep dive into the negatives of the primary candidates, or in the case of the last election, Michaels, doesn't do us well come the general election. Just my opinion / conclusions based upon observation and experience. Feel free to ignore. Nick, and I signed it with my name and title. But, you know, talk radio conservatives and talking heads, there's still a huge contingent of Republicans, including talk radio down here, who are so desiring of anyone other than Trump. You know, now this red wave that didn't materialize, which I would argue there was no evidence there was going to be a red wave. The polling didn't show a red wave. The polling showed tight races across the country. So this whole red wave was just an assumption made by Republican talking heads. And now these Republican talking heads are all, oh, Trump's got to go. So there's still a huge contingent of Republicans, including talk radio down here, who are so desiring of anybody other than Trump. I think conservative talkers, Dan O'Donnell being one, I think deep down they seek the adoration and the member of the club status that only liberal media elites get. I think that there is a there's a savior Republican out there who will have conservative policies and not be hated by the left. A savior Republican that they can support and be proud of, when they don't feel like they have to have an inferiority complex for supporting, when they don't have to say, well, I support Trump, but his personality is abrasive and he shouldn't tweet, blah, 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 blah. I think this crowd is ready to point to anything that doesn't go Republicans' way and say, see, look, we need to move past Trump. So they're not exactly never Trumpers. I'll call them their ashamed Trumpers. And I don't think they realize that the liberals turned the son of a preacher man, Scott Eagle Scout Walker, into Hitler of the Midwest. And they don't realize if their conservative celebrity crush DeSantis becomes the front runner, he will be instantly portrayed and painted as the devil incarnate also. I mean, I just think some Republicans just have to face reality. You can have freedom or you can be popular with the celebrity class, but you can't have both. So, I mean, talking heads are pissing and moaning about Trump and blaming Trump for the lack of a red wave. And I think it's total bullshit. I think they're just doing what talking heads do, is grabbing facts and claiming they support their conjecture. And they say that people Trump picked weren't strong. You know, Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Look, Pennsylvania is so messed up and shady that I wouldn't use Pennsylvania as a barometer for anything. I mean, Pennsylvania elected a half-brain dead guy, literally. Also in Pennsylvania, they elected a guy who's dead. I mean, the Democrats of Pennsylvania, they would elect the devil. Anyone who would have been put up would have lost in Pennsylvania. No facts prove otherwise. It just, I mean, Fetterman was he's literally half brain dead from his stroke. And he wins. He was as flawed of a candidate as there was. So I don't think just because Dr. Oz was Trump's pick, I don't think that the other candidate in the primary, I forget his name, but I don't think he would have done, I don't think he would have beat Fetterman. Now let's look at Herschel Walker. You know, Herschel Walker, people say, oh, candidate quality, and Mitch McConnell can bitch about candidate quality and throw shade during the campaign. I mean, what the? Mitch McConnell bitching about candidate quality during the campaign publicly. But let's look at Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker, he's going to the runoff. Remember in 2020, in the runoffs, both of the more establishment traditional Republican-type candidates lost to Raphael Warnock and that other senator from Georgia. Herschel Walker may well win. So again, these talking heads are trying to grab events and claim that they mean we need to get past Trump and so candidate quality. Now look, I'm not married to Trump. I mean, for me, freedom first. We have to win in 2024. I think Trump is still the favorite, and I think he would have won in a landslide in 2020 without the cheating. He got 12 million more votes than his first election. I think he won people over. Now, is the electorate really sick of him? I mean, I don't know, maybe. I don't really see evidence of it. Now, look, I love DeSantis. I mean, I love the guy. But I truly believe it's important to stand for people who stood for you. And I think Trump, I think a Trump-DeSantis ticket is the best ticket, which would be 12 years of swamp busting. I think that's the dream team ticket. And I think instead of bashing Trump, people should be calling for a Trump-DeSantis ticket. Trump's an instant lame duck, but he could hit the ground running his second term because he's figured out how to get the right people in the right places. Remember the first half of his first term, he struggled with people on his own staff undermining him, the leakers, the establishment folks he had to bring into staff and administration. He got it figured out and still got great things done during the meantime, but Trump could hit the ground running. And DeSantis could have an outsized role as heir apparent and a great communicator as the vice president. Because again, Trump's a lame duck. The minute he's elected, it's his last term. Now, all that said, it really does come down to the voters, not the talking heads. But I wonder how much influence the talking heads will have on the voters. I mean, I don't know. But I wouldn't count Trump out. I mean, Trump's a winner. And here's another thing. You know, Ron Johnson, he was not a Trump selection. Ron Johnson was a product of the Tea Party. And Ron Johnson had a tight race too, a tight, tight race. So lots of candidates who were not Trump hand-selected candidates, they had tight races. They weren't like blowout landslide victories. So it's not Trump's fault the Democrats have a fantastic vote collection machine. I mean, if anything, it's the GOP's fault, the formal Republican Party. Now, Trump didn't lose Wisconsin for Michaels. That was Tim Michaels' fault, and I'll say the Wisconsin GOP's fault. But isn't it just like the GOP establishment to blame anyone but themselves? I mean, where is the get-out-the-vote structure for the Wisconsin GOP? The Democrats have it. A candidate can't put together the kind of get-out-the-vote effort that it takes to win. I mean, it takes years to build that. Democrats have that, year to year to year, that structure. Where's the Republican one? I mean, I got texts from the Waukesha County Party in my school board election this past spring. But nothing, it was like this WIS-RED initiative, nothing this election. A good get-out-the-vote effort and a ground game, it's years in the making, requiring data and people and organization. And you can't expect a candidate to put that together in 2 months between winning a primary in August in Wisconsin and the general election in November. Yet all the blame on Michaels. And the Wisconsin GOP, I promise you, the WIS GOP will not blame themselves. They never do. Oh, it's Trump's fault. Oh, it's Michael's fault. Candidate quality. I mean, it's unreal. But all these people, these Republican elites and the talking heads, they've got Trump on a skewer already, and the votes aren't even counted yet. Like, look at Arizona. Carrie Lake, she may win, and she thinks she's going to win. And I think the evidence that she presents, because of these votes that were dropped off on Election Day, are going to skew for her. I think Carrie Lake is going to win, and she was the biggest firebrand pro-Trump MAGA Republican out there this year. But Republican heads, talking heads, already have Trump on a skewer, and again, Carrie Lake is probably going to win and win comfortably. But yet, a day after the election, Republicans are like, oh, get past Trump, the New York Post, oh, we got to move on to DeSantis. And the votes aren't even counted yet. We don't even know who's going to control. I mean, it's astonishing me. You'd think the talking heads in the Republican Party would sit back and, like, let some information come in. But nope, they're already out there. And it's affecting people. Because it does affect these people who listen to talk radio that are feeling lost and frustrated because they feel like their country's lost and they're feeling desperate. And also they're like, yeah, we got to get past Trump. I mean, it's having an effect that these talking heads on conservative media should be the voice of reason. Hey, calm down. We've got plenty of time to figure this out. All hands on deck for the runoff in Georgia. Let's talk after the first of the year about the Republican primary and moving the party forward. But the other thing is, all these talking heads who are now skewering Trump, has anyone considered the suppressive effect that this red tsunami and red wave may have had on conservative vote? I mean, how many half-motivated voters it's supposed to be a red tsunami, red wave, so I mean, I don't need to vote. It's not going to be a close election. It's a red wave year. Ron Johnson barely won, and he wasn't a Trump selection. So it's not like the non-Trump candidates did great. And of course, Ron Johnson was also endorsed by Trump. So it's not like the endorsement was a killer. So it still comes down to Republicans need to make issues out of things that are not issues but will be. Example, forced vaccinations. That's coming. Medical tyranny is coming. The Democrats pushed all that off the table for election year, but it's coming back. Republicans should have brought it up and made it a campaign issue. Regarding crime, I've realized crime doesn't sell out state. Crime is out of control in Democrat-controlled areas, but those areas will still vote Democrat. So pushing crime statewide, it doesn't – the people out in Johnson Creek and Watertown and Wausau and Dodgeville and Mount Horeb and – Montrose and Hixton, Wisconsin. I mean, they're not affected by crime. I mean, yeah, crime's out of control in Milwaukee, and that affects, you know, Brookfield and New Berlin now, but outstate, crime is not a winning issue outstate. But what else was missing from the campaigns of Ron Johnson and Tim Michaels? The 80-20 issues. Boys competing in girls' sports, that should have been a campaign issue. That should have been campaign commercials. Did you see Ron Johnson or Tim Michaels put an ad? Tim Michaels should have had an ad that says, when I'm governor, there will not be boys competing in girls' sports in Wisconsin. Didn't do it. When I'm governor, there will not be boys and girls' bathrooms in Wisconsin. There was a girl in Virginia that was raped by a trans boy in the bathroom. This is a big story out there. Immigration, another 80-20 issue. No commercials on it. And the media is not going to make these issues because the media runs away from these. You know, gun control. They were silent on gun control during the election. There was no, you know, Democrats, they don't go doing campaign commercials. Tony Evers did no campaign commercial. Yeah, I support, I would consider mandatory gun buybacks because that's what he said in 2019, that he would support mandatory gun buybacks. He didn't put, Tony Evers didn't turn that into a commercial. That wouldn't have helped him. Now, here's another thing I'll say. Back in 2020, when Evers was very, very, very vulnerable, there was a recall effort. And you know who didn't get behind it? The Wisconsin GOP did not get behind the recall effort. It had to be done by that lady who supposedly had a shady past, so they say. And if the former Republican Party would have gotten behind that recall effort, Tony Evers would have had to face election back in 2020 when he was very vulnerable, when Kenosha was still smoldering, when people were still worried about riots, when people were getting sick of COVID mandates and Tony Evers was still trying to shove them down our throats. Tony Evers would have been facing a recall election. But the Wisconsin GOP and the reason they didn't support it was because Becky Clefishy, she wasn't ready. She wasn't ready to run. She hadn't fundraised. She hadn't started her, you know, her PACs and didn't have anything all lined up. So because Becky Homecki wasn't ready, because Clefishy wasn't ready to run, the formal party didn't get behind the recall effort. Because then who knows who would have jumped in the race. Eric Humvee? I mean, you know, nope. So I'll bet the, you know, so now, oh, no, Evers will still be vulnerable in 2022. Yeah, that's what they said. That's what Ryan Priebus said. That's what others said. Oh, Evers will still be just as vulnerable in 2022. Let's wait till 2022 and we'll get him then. Well, you didn't get him. Maybe you should have done the recall. Maybe you should have got behind the recall, WIS GOP. But the only person I'm hearing no blame for is the Wisconsin GOP. That's so typical. So typical. Anyway, so that's the show for tonight. We've got now winter is, we went from summer / late summer weather to winter. I guess now they're talking about snow for this week. Couple inches. It doesn't sound like it's going to stick around, like it could melt, but yeah, it's a you know, and that's the thing. Like I used to sit there and look at the weather calendar, which would talk about the average daily high. And if you look at the average daily high in Wisconsin, you're like, yeah, the weather's not bad here. I mean, it's the average daily high is, you know, above 60 degrees for most of the year. That's nice weather. But then you don't realize that in Wisconsin, that average is never really average. You end up getting extremes. You get a couple nice days and then crazy cold days. And then, you know, April's like, you know, you get a nice 60 degree day, above average day, and then 40. Excuse me. And it all averages out to what looks like a reasonable temperature, a comfortable, livable temperature, but it ends up being the result. It ends up being, even winter, you got January, you got a 40 degree day and then below zero. And then, yeah, it averages out to 30 degree high temperature. But anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week and carry on. And yeah, here Elon says ice fishing is around the corner. So hope you're making the best of this weather and not letting the weather get the best of you. Have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.